Chapter 39 Redeemers. For the most part, Grant sat out the 1876 presidential contest while his cabinet was far more actively engaged. Secretary of the Interior Chandler managed the campaign of Rutherford B. Hayes and chaired the Republican National Committee, while others pitched in with supporting speeches. With extreme trepidation, Grant monitored a race that threatened to reverse gains made by the Republican Party and black voters across the South. In August, John Roy Lynch, the black Mississippi congressman, saw that the Democratic revival overtaking the South would make the electoral math very difficult for Hayes. "Every Southern state the Democrats proposed to carry as they carried Mississippi last year, not by the power of the ballot, but by an organized system of terrorism and violence." However aloof he was from campaigning, Grant remained committed to the safety of black voters. While staying at the Pennsylvania home of William W. Smith in late September, members of a colored men's marching club came to serenade him. Grant expressed pleasure that blacks had been so faithful to the Union and reiterated his belief that voting remained the cardinal right in a democracy. As reported in the Pittsburgh Telegraph, Grant said that it was his purpose to see that every man of every race and condition should have the privilege of voting his sentiments without violation or intimidation. When this was secured, we would then, and only then, deserve to be called a free republic. Having long shied away from speeches, Grant, as a lame duck president, seemed much more open and quicker to spout fundamental beliefs. In the presidential race, Democrats feasted on the frequent scandals that had plagued Grant's second term, and at times seemed to run against Grantism rather than Hayes. Republicans cast Democrats as thinly disguised slaveholders, one prominent Republican thundering, "Every man that loved slavery better than liberty was a Democrat. Every man that raised bloodhounds to pursue human beings was a Democrat." Though more sympathetic to white Southern concerns than Grant, Hayes nonetheless advised his campaign managers to exploit fears of rebel rule and a solid South. As rebel banners were waved defiantly across the South, Grant worried that a rejuvenated Democratic Party would demand compensation for freed slaves. He especially dreaded a growing Southern canard that the Civil War had been a war of Northern aggression, with a moral equivalence drawn between the two sides. As he told a newspaper, he regretted Democratic claims that Confederate soldiers fought honestly as American citizens for an honest purpose and in as good a spirit as the Northern soldiers who have been pensioned, and that they were provoked and driven into the war by the North. This revisionist thesis was propagated by lost cause ideologues who venerated Lee and depreciated Grant as a butcher, who had only defeated his rebel counterpart by dint of superior manpower. Grant knew that Reconstruction was imperiled and that the legal props were being kicked out from under it. In 1876, the Supreme Court handed down two rulings, United States v. Cruikshank and United States v. Reese, that gutted portions of the Enforcement Act of 1870 and narrowed the powers of the 14th and 15th Amendments. Grant did what he could to protect Southern blacks and their threatened voting rights. When the House of Representatives passed a resolution to strengthen enforcement of the 15th Amendment, he directed Sherman to hold forces ready for protecting all citizens without distinction of race, color, or political opinion in the exercise of the right to vote as guaranteed by the 15th Amendment. But Reconstruction was clearly ebbing, the federal military presence in the South having waned to slightly more than 3,000 officers and men. The need for federal troops hadn't faded, as evidenced by havoc in Hamburg, South Carolina, on July 4, 1876, the date of America's centennial. South Carolina was one of three Southern states remaining in the Republican column, Florida and Louisiana being the others, and it faced unrelenting pressure from whites to redeem their state for the Democrats. At Hamburg, a scuffle arose when two white farmers in a buggy protested that their path was barred by a parade of local black militia. Before long, militia leaders were jailed for obstructing a public highway. White vengeance wasn't yet sated. In the coming days, armed whites from South Carolina and nearby Georgia, including members of rifle clubs and saber companies, gathered in Hamburg to demand that local black militia relinquish their weapons. The latter took refuge in a small brick building used as an armory and a drill room, but the swelling white mob blew out its windows with musket and cannon fire. Believing their assailants would soon blow up the building, blacks leapt from the windows or climbed down an escape ladder only to be gunned down in cold blood. 5 men in a row were executed, and 3 more wounded as they attempted to flee. James Cook, the black town marshal, was shot and his skull smashed in with muskets. The Republican governor, Daniel H. Chamberlain, was a lawyer from Massachusetts, a Yale graduate who had been an officer in a black Union regiment during the war. Writing to Secretary of War Cameron, he deplored the Hamburg massacre as a butchery of unoffending and unarmed colored men by a brutal and bloodthirsty mob of white men. He thought the episode more shocking than the massacre of Custer's men, who were at least shot in open battle. The victims at Hamburg were murdered in cold blood after they had surrendered and were utterly defenseless. The homes of nearly every black family in town were pillaged, while mutilated bodies of the murdered men broiled in sunlight for days, their families too petrified to retrieve them. On July 17th, the U.S. Marshal in Charleston appealed to Attorney General Taft to send federal troops to Hamburg. Without consulting the president, the conservative Taft dismissed the action as unconstitutional. On July 22nd, Governor Chamberlain wrote directly to Grant, portraying the Hamburg massacre as part of a systematic campaign of violence and blood to breed terror among black voters. The murders had bred a feeling of triumph and political elation in the minds of a considerable part of the white people and Democrats. The governor asked Grant to exercise federal power vigilantly in the state. In an impassioned reply, Grant revealed the depth of his emotional commitment to black security. "The scene at Hamburg, as cruel, bloodthirsty, wanton, unprovoked, and as uncalled for as it was, is only a repetition of the course that has been pursued in other southern states within the last few years, notably in Mississippi and Louisiana. Mississippi is governed today by officials chosen through fraud and violence, such as would scarcely be accredited to savages, much less to a civilized and Christian people. How long these things are to continue, or what is to be the final remedy, the great ruler of the universe only knows. There has never been a desire on the part of the North to humiliate the South. Nothing is claimed for one state that is not freely accorded to all the others, unless it may be the right to kill Negroes and Republicans without fear of punishment and without loss of caste or reputation." Although Grant stopped short of dispatching federal troops, he promised, "I will give every aid for which I can find law or constitutional power." Historians have criticized Grant for not hastening troops to South Carolina, but in the new, less forgiving political climate, he was obliged to demonstrate that the state governor had done everything in his power to handle the problem alone. That Grant was profoundly disturbed by the killings is unquestionable. Transmitting to the Senate documents about the Hamburg slaughter, Grant's term, he alluded to murders and massacres of innocent men in Louisiana as well. "All are familiar with their horrible details, the only wonder being that so many justify them or apologize for them." Throttled by dwindling Republican support for Reconstruction, Grant compensated by expressing his frustration in white-hot language. That summer, white Democrats in South Carolina united around the gubernatorial candidacy of Wade Hampton III, a former Confederate cavalry officer who was aided by paramilitary rifle clubs known as Red Shirts. L. Cass Carpenter, an internal revenue collector in South Carolina, warned Grant in August that Hampton and his followers were plotting to regain control of the state government. When Carpenter attended Republican election meetings, he shuddered at the spectacle of hundreds of armed, mounted white men, members of rifle and saber clubs, who were there to intimidate the speakers and the assemblage gathered to hear them. David T. Corbin, U.S. attorney in Greenville, investigated the Hamburg butchery and told of insuperable obstacles to prosecutions, blaming the terror of the witnesses to testify, the constant fear of assassination if they do. He concluded that juries will not convict on any proof, however good. The Hamburg carnage preceded far worse atrocities in October in Ellenton, South Carolina. Two black burglars allegedly entered a white woman's home and struck her with a stick, prompting a murderous binge by hundreds of lethally armed whites from rifle clubs. They executed blacks ranging from a 90-year-old man to a 17-year-old adolescent who had his ear sliced off. Simon Coker, a black state legislator, was gunned down in an open field. At least 17 blacks were slain within a week. So widespread was the savagery that the estimated death toll of black victims ran as high as 150. In its aftermath, black citizens of Aiken sent Grant a heartbreaking description of their plight. "We write to tell you that our people are being shot down like dogs, and no matter what Democrats may say, unless you help us, our folks will not dare go to the polls." On October 11th, Governor Chamberlain employed the requisite language for tapping federal troops, notifying Grant that insurrection and domestic violence in three counties near the Georgia border exceeded the state's power to control it. 6 days later, Grant ordered rifle clubs, who ride up and down by day and night in arms, murdering some peaceable citizens and intimidating others, to disperse and retire peaceably to their homes. Secretary of War Cameron dispatched troops the same day. Now approaching the finale of his second term, Grant threw aside political caution and Northern ambivalence to protect black and white Republicans in the South. It was a reminder to Northern Republicans that, despite the scandals in his administration, Grant had almost always been most courageous where it counted, in protecting freed people. Many Northern Republicans applauded his stand, although Democrats complained that he was favoring the Hayes slate. "Today I was again impressed with the belief that when his presidential term is ended, General Grant will regain his place as one of the foremost of Americans," James Garfield reflected. About 1,000 federal troops had shown up in South Carolina by Election Day, not sufficient to avert all violence, but enough to provide a modicum of safety to defenseless Republicans. As one grateful white Republican reassured Grant, "Without federal troops, any man, white or colored, who would have dared to cheer Hayes would have had his head taken off." Mississippi remained a racial tinderbox. Blanche Ames, the outgoing governor's wife, pointed out that among the principal men in the state capital, there is hardly one who has not, by counsel or action, taken some part in the Negro murders. In September, the U.S. Marshal in Oxford, James H. Pierce, informed Attorney General Taft that a perfect reign of terror existed in three Mississippi counties, making Republicans afraid to vote. At least 10 companies of federal troops, he estimated, would be required to suppress the mayhem. Hobbled by the hostile northern climate, the best Grant could do was to deploy 3 companies in the bloodstained counties. Aside from outright violence, white liners terrified black voters by forcing them to reveal their employers before they voted, thus exposing them to economic reprisals. The terror tactics worked. On Election Day in November, only 2 Republicans dared to vote in all of Yazoo County, only 1 in Tallahatchie County. In Louisiana, whites were set to purge the state and redeem it from Republican control. In September, Grant had received disturbing messages that electoral fraud would undermine presidential voting. The Republican Senator Joseph Rodman West believed whites were reenacting the Civil War, organizing their local Democratic Party with as much method and discipline as were the armies of the Confederacy. As Louisiana Democrats took power by coercion, the resulting violence assumed horrific proportions. Rifle clubs and white liners carried out a murderous vendetta against black Republicans on the Saturday before Election Day. as investigators later wrote. They visited the house of Abram Williams, an old colored Republican, 60 years of age. He was taken from his house, stripped, and severely whipped. They visited the house of Willis Fraser, took him also from his bed, and brutally whipped him. They visited the house of a son of Abram Williams. He had taken the precaution to spend the night in the cotton field. Not finding him at home, they whipped his wife and committed another outrage upon her person. Merriman Rhodes, on that night, was killed. A few days later, his body, disemboweled, was found in the bayou and was buried. They visited the house of Randall Driver. They took him from his bed and from his house and brutally whipped him. They visited the house of Henry Pinkston. He was taken from his bed, from his house, and shot to death. His infant child was killed. His wife was cut in different places. She was shot and nearly slain. On Election Day, 1876, Western Union hooked up a telegraph to bring presidential results directly to the White House. Tilden decisively swept the popular vote with a 250,000 margin, but with 184 electoral votes, fell one short of the 185 required for victory. Nonetheless, as Grant gathered with Republican leaders, the prevailing sense was that Tilden had won, and the White House mood darkened accordingly. Sherman, with his usual impetuosity, was pacing the room, recalled John Eaton, lamenting with some profanity the fate of the nation, and especially of the army, should the Democrats assume control. But Grant was perfectly calm and apparently serene. Slowly, the extraordinary prospect dawned that Hayes, who could claim with certainty only 166 electoral votes, might pull off an upset victory. Disputed results in the three unredeemed southern states, Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina, could, if all resolved in his favor, provide him with 19 votes, tipping him over the edge to a one-vote victory with 185 votes. The stage was now set for an electoral deadlock and an explosive constitutional crisis. The day after the election, Grant traveled to Philadelphia for the closing ceremonies of the Centennial Exhibition. He stayed at the residence of George Childs, where Republican bigwigs pored over returns that documented the most closely contested presidential race in American history. They rejoiced when it appeared Hayes might win, but Grant sought to disarm their premature optimism. "Gentlemen," he pronounced, "it looks to me as if Mr. Tilden was elected." Though scarcely pleased by an ostensible Democratic victory, Grant was fully prepared to bow to the electorate's wishes. "Everything depends now upon a fair count," he told the press. While attending a closing banquet for the exhibition, Grant hurried from the hall when an emergency telegram arrived from Interior Secretary Chandler, who related a grisly saga of having dispatched a train southward to verify election returns, only to have it Ku Kluxed and thrown from the track. "There is no doubt of our majority if we can secure an honest canvass," Chandler predicted, "but the indications are that violence is to be freely resorted to prevent any returns from remote points in the interior. We shall need an army to protect us." To deal with a spreading threat of disorder, Democrats began to rally to the cry of "Tilden or blood." Grant mustered the stamina to weather one last crisis. He rushed Colonel Thomas H. Ruger to Florida and backed him with troops to ensure a quiet, peaceful ballot count, while he ordered General Christopher C. Augur to do the same in Louisiana. Grant proved remarkably fair-minded, declaring that should there be any grounds of suspicion of fraudulent counting on either side, it should be reported and denounced at once. "Either party can afford to be disappointed in the result, but the country cannot afford to have the result tainted by the suspicion of illegal or false returns." This remained his unswerving policy during the high-stakes drama now unfolding. The Northern press cheered Grant's actions in sending troops to avert vote tampering in Louisiana, South Carolina, and Florida. But until final returns were certified in these states, it was impossible to name a new president, and the political system wobbled in a dangerous limbo. Though scrupulously even-handed, Grant was demonized by Southern Democrats, and rumors proliferated that he would be killed. John Singleton Mosby advised him to heed this rash talk. "I met Mosby on my way to the president's," Hamilton Fish wrote, "and he told me that the language of the Democrats now was more desperate and more threatening and violent than that of the Southern men on the election of Lincoln in 1860. To illustrate the vengeful Southern mood, Mosby told how he himself had been threatened with arrest because he prevented a Democrat at the polls from clubbing a colored voter and had insisted on the right of the Negro to vote. True to Mosby's prediction, Grant was peppered with death threats. One anonymous writer, signing himself "An Outlaw of the West," gave him 3 weeks to prepare for his maker. "I am bound under oath to take your life." Klan members sent a letter adorned with a skull and crossbones, warning, "You and your assistant thieves will soon be assassinated." At the same time, rumors floated about that a secret Democratic army would stage a military raid on Washington and declare Tilden the winner. To guard against this menace, Grant and Sherman redeployed troops from the interior to Washington and secured the federal arsenal along with 3 critical bridges leading to the Capitol. The crisis came to a head in South Carolina. After the election, Grant heard stories of rifle clubs ringing polling places, allowing only Democrats to vote. Both the Republican Governor Chamberlain and the Democratic contender Wade Hampton had claimed victory in the gubernatorial contest. On November 24th, with the legislature slated to meet, Chamberlain told Grant that armed and violent Democrats would seek to block the session. 2 days later, Grant and several cabinet members pondered reports that up to 8,000 rifle company members in South Carolina might seize the state legislature. On the spot, Grant instructed Secretary of War Cameron that Chamberlain was still the legally constituted governor, facing resistance too formidable to be overcome by the state authorities, and should have all necessary support against domestic violence. A few days later, Democrats invaded the South Carolina legislature, installing their own speaker and clerk and leaving the state in turmoil. As one black railway porter told Grant, "At every stop on the train, white men sent up hosannas for Wade Hampton and damnation to every Negro, Grant, Chamberlain, and company. For God's sake, General, help me to come out of this country of assassins." South Carolina now had 2 governors and 2 state legislatures, greatly complicating the electoral fight over the presidency. Just when Grant thought he could disengage from turbulent racial politics and contemplate a tranquil post-presidential life, he was thrust back into some of the thorniest dilemmas ever to confront an American chief executive. At a dramatic cabinet session, Cameron proposed that federal troops eject the Democratic speaker and clerk from the South Carolina legislature, reinstating their Republican counterparts. When he swore, "This is war and revolution," Grant retorted, "Decidedly no. No, it is no such thing." Remembering the brouhaha over Sheridan's expelling legislators in New Orleans, Grant explained that the president should not tamper with state politics, but simply provide a safe, peaceful setting for states to resolve their own disputes. He relayed this advice to Colonel Ruger in South Carolina, imploring him to avoid unlawful use of the military by taking men claiming seats out of the legislative hall. On December 3rd, Grant received Tilden's campaign manager, Representative Abram S. Hewitt of New York, and made it clear he would accept Tilden as the next president if he were lawfully chosen. With unusual vehemence, he defended his actions in South Carolina, where he thought Democrats had stolen the election from Hayes by scaring away black voters, and he cited the need for federal troops when white rifle clubs ruled the state. He also made it crystal clear that if an armed mob attacked Congress, he would defend it. So wound up was the taciturn Grant that he spoke for a straight hour, perhaps a record outburst for him. As the New York Times marveled, "The president himself told a Republican congressman this morning that he made the longest speech he had ever made in his life." Approaching the end of his presidency, Grant again seemed more vocal and expressive in his comments, providing glimpses into an emotional life ordinarily screened by his opaque personality. The electoral crisis reached a new phase on December 6th, when the Electoral College electors were scheduled to meet in their respective capitals and cast their votes for president. It quickly became apparent that a new president could not be named because three of the contested states with warring governments, South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana, filed one set of election certificates for Hayes and another for Tilden. Their returning boards, which verified the election returns, were in Republican hands, further tainting the results in Democratic eyes. Faced with this agonizing dilemma, Congress in mid-December called for a special bipartisan committee to settle the electoral crisis and favored the creation of a tribunal whose authority none can question and whose decision all will accept as final. Meanwhile, Grant had to deal with this dangerous stalemate. Repeatedly, he heard how Democratic ruffians scraped off the Baltimore and New York streets would inflict mayhem on the Capitol, murdering the president and kidnapping Hayes. When a patriotic delegation appeared at the White House, styling themselves the Stars and Stripes Association and offering to protect the Capitol, Grant calmed them by saying there would be no disturbance. A cool hand at the helm, he prevented a frightening situation from fraying into partisan violence. As always, Grant was at his most level-headed in a crisis. With memories of the Civil War still fresh, another bloody clash was far from unthinkable. As in the past, Louisiana presented seemingly insurmountable problems. After the election, Grant heard of ballot boxes being destroyed there by Democrats and sent Senator John Sherman, Congressman Garfield, and other prominent observers to scrutinize the canvassers tallying the count. Sherman's report described a travesty of justice. So intimidated had black voters been by night riders that overwhelmingly Republican parishes ended up in the Democratic column. Organized clubs of masked, armed men, formed as recommended by the Central Democratic Committee, rode through the country at night, marking their course by the whipping, shooting, wounding, maiming, mutilation, and murder of women, children, and defenseless men. A Senate investigating committee later ascertained that in a single parish, more than 60 black Republicans had been butchered before the election. Louisiana Republicans and Democrats, in their eternal squabble, had formed rival state legislatures. Grant promised to act in a nonpartisan fashion, but his neutrality was tested when thousands of armed White League members laid siege to the State House, trained their guns on the courthouse, and ejected the sheriff. On January 11th, Grant oversaw an acrimonious cabinet debate about what to do. Solidly interventionist in the past, he momentarily allied himself with conservatives. James D. Cameron and Zachariah Chandler grew exasperated that Grant wanted to wait until shots were fired before sending in federal troops. Despite Grant's hesitation, he then came down hard on the side of the new Republican governor, Stephen B. Packard, telling General Augur he would not tolerate a state government being taken over by illegal means. Tired of the cutthroat politics in Washington, Grant labored under excruciating pressure as he confronted a choice of political poisons: either intervene in state politics and invite a northern outcry, or stand back and allow thuggery to reign supreme in Louisiana. On January 17th, Fish recorded an extraordinary conversation with a distraught Grant, who was so upset by Louisiana events that he couldn't sleep. He seemed to be edging toward a nervous collapse and even doubted for a moment the wisdom of his past policies. He railed against incompetent carpetbag governors in the South who had no interest there but had simply gone there to hold office, and so soon as they should lose it, intended to come away. He also seemed to oppose the very black voting rights he had so courageously upheld. He says he is opposed to the 15th Amendment and thinks it was a mistake, that it had done the Negro no good and had been a hindrance to the South and by no means a political advantage to the North. 2 years later, in a discussion with the journalist John Russell Young, Grant clarified what he meant, saying that the 14th Amendment had bolstered Southern power by scrapping the rule that had once counted an African-American as only 3/5 of a person for electoral purposes. Despite suppressing the vote of blacks, white Southerners could now count them fully for election purposes, giving the solid South 40 extra votes in the Electoral College and disproportionate influence in American politics. They keep those votes, but disfranchise the Negroes. That is one of the gravest mistakes in the policy of Reconstruction. However eager Grant might be for a Hayes presidency, he knew he would be crippled if his election rested on the outcome in 2 or 3 questionable Southern states. In late January, Grant signed an act creating a bipartisan electoral commission, composed of 5 members of each House and 5 Supreme Court justices, to judge the validity of election returns from the contested states. Grant saw this as a peaceful exit, a wise and constitutional means of escape from the political abyss into which the nation had sunk. The final seat on the commission went to Joseph P. Bradley of New Jersey, the Republican Supreme Court justice chosen by Grant, and gave Republicans an 8-7 edge on the panel. While the Electoral Commission deliberated in February, Grant longed to be free of the intolerable burdens of office. "But 3 weeks remain until I close my official career," he told Edwards Pierpont. "Although so short a time, it appears to me interminable. My anxiety to be free from care is so great." On February 9th, Hayes won the Florida vote, and on February 16th, the Louisiana vote, stacking the odds heavily in his favor. "There is still some doubt, but apparently very little, of the result," a satisfied Hayes wrote in his diary. "I would like to get support from good men of the South, late rebels. How to do it is the question." Convinced Hayes would win, Grant sent him a cordial invitation to stay in the White House until the inauguration, but Hayes thought this unwise, given the murky situation, and he didn't arrive in Washington until March 2nd, right before the inauguration. Consequential to the election outcome were the many private contacts in the Capitol between Southern Democrats and Hayes's Northern Republican supporters. At Wormley's Hotel on February 26th, 5 Hayes people pledged that federal troops would be withdrawn from the South, new Redeemer governments would be tolerated, and home rule restored. The 4 Southern Democrats promised, in return, fair treatment of the black community. The influence of the so-called Wormley Conference has been greatly overstated, for it merely culminated months of bargaining and confirmed what was already clear: that Hayes would bring an end to Reconstruction. It was a Pyrrhic victory for Republicans, who sacrificed their idealism in exchange for perpetuating their rule. Shortly afterward, the Special Commission declared Hayes the winner in South Carolina, giving him a 185-184 victory in the Electoral College. Having ably presided over this troubled period, staying above the fray, Grant lauded the Electoral Commission as a fine bit of self-government on the part of the people. The 15-member body had split 8-7, leading one irate Democrat to object that "we have been cheated, shamefully cheated," while other Democrats bitterly emphasized Tilden's victory in the popular vote and satirized Hayes as "his fraudulency" or "Rutherford B. Hayes." Just as Grant got ready to leave office, the disputed election amplified Democratic animosity to a new level of verbal violence. Many thought the Electoral Commission had winked at cheating committed by Republicans in the South, but Democrats had clearly engaged in widespread voter intimidation, and Grant later stated that the real fraud has been perpetrated by those who are raising the cry of fraud. Despite the rancor, the prospect of 2 warring presidencies had been averted, and the inauguration of Hayes would proceed smoothly. All in all, Grant's impartial handling of the election in an extremely tense situation had been one of his finest achievements. He had prevented bloodshed and ensured a peaceful transition of power. "If Tilden was declared elected, I intended to hand him over the reins and see him peacefully installed," Grant said afterward. I should have treated him as cordially as I did Hayes, for the question of the presidency was then neither personal nor political, but national. The day that brought about the result and enabled me to leave the White House as I did, I regard as one of the happiest in my life. Grant's coolness in crisis and impeccable fairness reminded voters of why they had trusted him in the first place. "He comes up to the mark so grandly on great occasions," wrote Ebenezer Hoar, "that I wish he were more careful of appearances in smaller matters." Resolution of the crisis brought immediate solace to a terribly overwrought, sleepless president. "The change was not so apparent to the world," wrote Jesse Grant, "but to the family it was more than evident. The brooding gloom that had enveloped him as a cloak was gone, and with us he was all animation." During his 8 years in office, Grant had been bedeviled not so much by his policies, where his record was often excellent, but by personalities, where his record left much to be desired. When the cartoonist Thomas Nast visited him in his last months as president, he found him in a chastened mood, scandalized by the misbehavior of his underlings. "The president was overwhelmed. Wherever he turned, some new dishonor lay concealed." In his last annual message to Congress, he confessed with artless candor, "It was my fortune, or misfortune, to be called to the office of chief executive without any previous political training. Under such circumstances, it is but reasonable to suppose that errors of judgment must have occurred." His problems had stemmed from appointees, he said, many of them originally strangers. "It is impossible that where so many trusts are to be allotted, that the right parties should be chosen in every instance." Grant couldn't admit that some wayward appointees were old colleagues, notably Orville Babcock, whom he had known too well and stood by too long. He rightly noted that, as a president coping with the daunting sequel to the Civil War, he had wrestled with Herculean challenges. Nearly one half of the states had revolted against the government, and of those remaining faithful to the Union, a large percentage of the population sympathized with the rebellion and made an enemy in the rear almost as dangerous as the honorable enemy in the front. He had overseen the trajectory from slavery to full-fledged freedom for 4 million black citizens. As the first president to govern after the 15th Amendment, he had guaranteed the exercise of brand new black voting rights and opposed the spate of domestic terrorism it engendered. He had been a good steward of the nation's finances, having slashed taxes, trimmed debt, and watched the trade balance turn from deficit to surplus. He had shown that government could make good on its pledge to repay war debt and restore American credit. Unable to let go of Santo Domingo, he pleaded one last time that by its annexation, the emancipated race of the South would have found there a congenial home, where their civil rights might have stood unimpaired. At the end of the address, Grant acknowledged that his presidency would soon end, and he delivered a plaintive farewell to politics, a fickle world he had never fully mastered. "It is not probable that public affairs will ever again receive attention from me further than as a citizen of the Republic, always taking a deep interest in the honor, integrity, and prosperity of the whole land." The address was an odd mixture of apologia and self-assertion, the New York Tribune describing it as the statement of a man who is weary of public life and tired of political strife. Grant was haunted by his diminished popularity and the loss of his heroic aura. To Congressman Abram S. Hewitt, he confided that for 16 years he had borne the entire weight of the nation on his shoulders, without any interval of rest or any possibility of being free from great responsibility. Now he was at last free to set down that awesome burden. When Jesse Grant returned from Cornell University that Christmas, he found his father wan and worn and wrapped in a brooding silence that even the family could not dispel. "We're going, Jesse," his father said forlornly. "That's settled. We start as soon as possible after my successor is installed. We will take whatever money there is, and we will go as far and stay as long as it lasts." Only the thought of a round-the-world trip sustained his flagging mood. Whatever the cares of his presidency, Grant must have trembled at the specter of returning to private life, a world where he had stumbled so miserably. While the presidency had contained its quota of nightmarish moments for Grant, it had been a fairy-tale existence for Julia, who now busied herself with stocking the larder and preparing the White House for the advent of the Hayes family. She was inwardly heartbroken and made no bones about the fact that she was wedded to their celebrity in the White House. One day her husband returned from Capitol Hill, exasperated by lawmakers, and exclaimed, "I wish this was over. I wish I had this Congress off my hands. I wish I was out of it altogether. After I leave this place, I never want to see it again." Julia looked up, rather startled.
"Why, Ulysses, how you talk. I never want to leave it."
For Julia, the White House sojourn had been not just a sacred public trust, but an enchanting social whirl. As she put it, "I wish it might have continued forever, except that it would have prevented others from enjoying the same privilege." A sense of tangible relief, coupled with a mood of wintry melancholy, took hold of Grant in his last days at the White House. Right before leaving office, he dined with General Augur, who was shaken by how downcast he was. "While smoking with the president after dinner, I spoke of his return to civil life, in which I said he would be free from the annoying burdens and vexatious attacks which were embittering his official career. To my dismay, the president said, with deep feeling, that he welcomed the change, because his confidence was badly shaken. He added that it was the saddest hour of his life, because he had come to realize that he did not know where to go outside of his family to find a man to be his confidential secretary in whom he could put entire trust." The exchange shows how scarred Grant had been by the betrayal of Babcock and other faithless subordinates. A lifelong naïf, Grant had been seared by Washington's cynical politics, which left a bitter aftertaste. On March 2nd, President-elect Hayes arrived at the White House and, giving way to strong emotion, grasped Grant by both hands. Momentarily overcome, the president-elect stood there speechless.
"Governor Hayes," Grant said, "I am glad to welcome you."
Under the law, the inauguration was supposed to take place on March 4th, but that fell on a Sunday, and Grant and Hayes balked at a Sabbath ceremony. Hence, on Saturday evening, March 3rd, Hayes was privately sworn in by Chief Justice Morrison Waite before dinner in the Red Room of the White House, an action recreated for show on Monday before a multitude of 30,000 citizens. On March 5th, Grant escorted Hayes to the Capitol for his public swearing-in. With a portly physique and silver-streaked hair, Grant had aged dramatically in the White House and looked more like the cartoon of a Gilded Age mogul than a battle-steeled general. After months of partisan turmoil, the inauguration proceeded without incident, and Garfield wrote of relief and joy that no accident had occurred on the route, for there were apprehensions of assassination. Perhaps motivated by a touch of pique, a teary-eyed Julia refused to escort her husband. She did not accompany her husband to the Capitol to see another man installed in the place which he had held, wrote Adam Badeau, adding, "It may not be improper to say just here that Mrs. Grant was unwilling to have her husband retire. She had desired him to become a candidate for another term." From later comments, we know the thoughts that buzzed through Grant's brain. As he told one newspaper man, "Personally, I was weary of office. I never wanted to get out of a place as much as I did to get out of the presidency." He felt like a boy getting out of school. After the inaugural ceremony, he and Julia hosted a large luncheon for the new president and his wife, as well as departing cabinet members. In taking leave of the new First Lady, Julia remarked, "Mrs. Hayes, I hope you will be as happy here as I have been for the last 8 years." The luncheon over, the Hayeses ushered the Grants to the portico and bid them an emotional farewell as they stepped into a carriage that would take them to Hamilton Fish's home for a 3-week stay. For all of Grant's avowed mistakes, Garfield was struck by what the nation owed him. No American has carried greater fame out of the White House than this silent man who leaves it today, he told his diary. As he left, Grant bore himself with a sturdy, soldierly composure, even though he stared into an indefinite future. Presidents didn't then qualify for pensions, and Grant was uncertain where or how he would earn his livelihood after his projected global journey. I have scarcely thought of where I will make my home on my return, he had told a friend. I am free to go wherever it seems to be the most agreeable. His itinerant army life had left him with no fixed abode, and if he felt at home anywhere, it was in Washington. As for Galena, he had spent only a year there, and almost all his old friends had died or moved. From a life excessively defined by duty, Grant was now free to abandon himself to wanderlust with all its attendant wonders and terrors. Like many ex-presidents, Grant experienced shock when the new president didn't automatically defer to his opinions and appointed critics of Reconstruction. He was mortified when his old foe, Carl Schurz, became Interior Secretary, while William M. Evarts ascended to Secretary of State. Much to Grant's chagrin, Hayes, an advocate of civil service reform, took issue with Roscoe Conkling and his New York patronage empire. Within a year, Hamilton Fish bemoaned to Grant that poor Hayes has given himself up, body and breeches, to the control of the most embittered hostility of the most disappointed of the liberals toward Grant and Grantism. He is amiable, I believe, but weak as dishwater. Hayes always denied there was any deal, but true to his informal understanding with the Democrats, he removed troops from the South, or at least from the state houses, returning them to their barracks, leaving blacks to the tender mercies of the vengeful white community. Reconstruction was now officially dead, and the Democratic Party in charge across the South. Half of what Grant gained at Appomattox, said Wendell Phillips, Hayes surrendered for us on the 5th of March. Yet many Northerners cheered the change. The Negro will disappear from the field of national politics, the nation pontificated with satisfaction. Henceforth, the nation, as a nation, will have nothing more to do with him. The so-called liberal wing of the Republican Party had abandoned blacks, while the stalwart Grant had kept the faith. Once he left office, some in the press rendered harsh judgments on his two terms. In an editorial brittle with patrician scorn, the nation made quick work of him, calling him coarse and blunt and fond of low company. One of Grant's most lacerating, if covert, critics was Sherman. When Grant leaves the White House, I fear he will sink out of sight and maybe worse, he told a friend. The transcendent fame he held at the close of the war will be clouded by the acts of his political administration, which history may stamp as corrupt and selfish. Decades later, Woodrow Wilson, a Southerner who detested Reconstruction, consigned President Grant to the dustbin of history. The honest, simple-hearted soldier had not added prestige to the presidential office. He ought never to have been made president. At moments, Grant had indeed been his own worst enemy, crossing the line that separates tenacity from obstinacy. But a class-ridden condescension accounts for some of the negative verdicts on Grant's presidency. It is easy to see why Grant is so often belittled, wrote David Herbert Donald, the eminent Lincoln biographer. He was not well-educated, was not articulate in arguments, was not flashy, and had no connection with the Eastern world of intellect and power. On the other hand, he was not merely a remarkable general, but a skillful and successful politician. After all, he was the only president between Abraham Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson to be elected to two consecutive terms of office. Donald singled out Grant as the most underrated American president. Grant has been vilified as an incompetent president for the scandals on his watch. Attacking him on that issue became a convenient tool for Reconstruction opponents, who sensationalized his failings through congressional hearings and a strident press. But corruption had flourished in American politics since the heyday of Andrew Jackson. Partly Grant's problem arose from poorly chosen appointees, but the main cause of the corruption under his aegis was the post-war expansion of the federal government with its myriad opportunities for graft. Although Grant took the first halting steps toward civil service reform, he should have championed the movement more vigorously and freed himself from the onus of patronage. His administration's reputation for cronyism and nepotism has obscured his exemplary record in appointing many groups hitherto excluded from American government, including African Americans, Jews, and Native Americans. It also overlooks the many outstanding figures, including Hamilton Fish, Amos Ackerman, Benjamin Bristow, and John Creswell, whom he appointed. In his final annual address, Grant affirmed that his Indian policy had largely been a success, notwithstanding the massacre at Little Bighorn. He had made a good-faith effort to eradicate corruption on reservations by appointing agents chosen by religious groups. In sharp contrast to Sherman and Sheridan, who spoke of Native Americans with cold-blooded contempt, Grant spoke of them sympathetically and frequently blamed the rapacity of white settlers for Indian misdeeds. His peace policy of trying to Christianize and civilize Native Americans, however flawed, had been pursued with honesty and must be given high marks for good intentions. Before he left office, Grant received a delegation of Choctaws, Chickasaws, Cherokees, and Creeks, who said, "On the eve of your retirement from office, we desire to express our appreciation of the course you have pursued towards our people while President of the United States. At all times just and humane, you have not failed to manifest an earnest wish for their advancement in the arts and pursuits of civilized life, a conscientious regard for their rights, and the full purpose to enforce in their behalf the obligations of the United States." Unfortunately, with Indian policy, as with Southern policy, there was no safe middle ground for Grant to stake out. To save Native Americans, he offered them a chance to retreat to reservations and copy the folkways of the white man, abandoning their traditional hunting economy. For many Indian tribes, this was unacceptable. In the end, neither Grant nor any American president could have resisted the massive flow of westward expansion, the political power of settlers, the money lust of mining companies, and the inexorable spread of railroads. Grant probably offered the tribes the best possible deal, although it fell dreadfully short of what they deemed necessary to their survival as a people. There was a tragic gap between what President Grant could reasonably propose and what the Indians could reasonably accept. Thanks to the diplomatic skills of Hamilton Fish, Grant had racked up a remarkably good record in foreign affairs. During his presidency, there was no war, no military swagger, no saber-rattling, and he stayed true to his motto, "Let us have peace." The Treaty of Washington, settling the Alabama claims, prevented war with England and opened the way for a close economic partnership, with British capital powering the rise of American industry. It also established a new benchmark for employing peaceful arbitration to settle international disputes instead of the traditional resort to warfare. It is no coincidence that Grant scored his foremost triumphs as president with two issues that grew out of the Civil War, settling the Alabama claims and fighting the Klan. For he had become the embodiment of that conflict and its mission to reunite the country and achieve justice for freed slaves. Ultimately, the appraisal of Grant's presidency rests upon posterity's view of Reconstruction. Grant took office when much of the South still lay under military rule. By the time he left, every Southern state had been absorbed back into the Union. For a long time after the Civil War, under the influence of Southern historians, Reconstruction was viewed as a catastrophic error, a period of corrupt carpetbag politicians and illiterate black legislators, presided over by the draconian rule of U.S. Grant. For more recent historians, led by Eric Foner, It has been seen as a noble experiment in equal justice for black citizens, in which they made remarkable strides in voting, holding office, owning land, creating small businesses and churches, and achieving literacy. About 2,000 blacks served as state legislators, tax collectors, local officials, and U.S. marshals, while 14 served in the House of Representatives and 2 in the Senate. The South witnessed a civil rights movement that briefly introduced desegregation and vouchsafed a vision of a functioning biracial democracy. Since Grant was president during this period, his standing was bound to rise with this revisionist view. Even as his party and cabinet became bitterly divided over Reconstruction, he showed a deep reservoir of courage in directing the fight against the Ku Klux Klan and crushing the largest wave of domestic terrorism in American history. It was Grant who helped to weave the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments into the basic fabric of American life. When Reconstruction was pilloried as a byword for political abuse, Grant was accused of going too far in advancing black civil rights and foisting bayonet rule on the South. Recent revisionist historians have sometimes swung to the other extreme, criticizing him for backtracking on Reconstruction during the last 2 years of his presidency, when he hesitated to send troops to police elections in Mississippi, South Carolina, and Louisiana. They condemn him for not undertaking extensive land reform in the South. A fine idea, but perhaps quixotic in a region dominated by the Klan and other terrorist groups. The true wonder is not that Grant finally retreated from robust federal intervention, but that he had the courage to persist for so long in his outspoken concern for black safety and civil rights as he faced a ferocious backlash from Democrats and even his own party. By the end of his second term, Northern support for Reconstruction had largely disappeared. As the Indiana Senator Oliver P. Morton recognized, if Reconstruction failed, it was not because of Grant, but because it had been resisted by armed and murderous organizations, by terrorism and proscription the most wicked and cruel of the age. Americans today know little about the terrorism that engulfed the South during Grant's presidency. It has been suppressed by a strange national amnesia. The Klan's ruthless reign is a dark, buried chapter in American history. The Civil War is far better known than its brutal aftermath. Without knowing that history, it is easy to find fault with Grant's tough, courageous actions. For Grant, Reconstruction amounted to a tremendous missed opportunity. There has never been a moment since Lee surrendered that I would not have gone more than halfway to meet the Southern people in a spirit of conciliation, but they have never responded to it. To protect blacks, Grant had been forced to send in federal troops whose presence provoked a virulent reaction among Southern whites who believed their home states had been invaded by hated Yankees a second time. Despite Grant's best efforts at Appomattox, the breach of the Civil War never healed, but became deeply embedded in American political culture. By the end of Grant's second term, white Democrats, through the Redeemer Movement, had reclaimed control of every Southern state, winning in peacetime much of the power lost in combat. They promulgated a view of the Civil War as a righteous cause that had nothing to do with slavery, but only states' rights, to which an incredulous James Longstreet once replied, "I never heard of any other cause of the quarrel than slavery." In this view, Reconstruction imposed an oppressive peace on honorable men who had laid down their arms. But the South never laid down its arms. When it came to African Americans, Southern Democrats managed to recreate the status quo ante, albeit minus slavery. Reconstruction was a fine but ultimately doomed experiment in American life. The tragedy of this intractable issue was that there was finally no way for blacks to enjoy their rights without a prolonged military presence, and that became politically impossible. Could even Abraham Lincoln have appeased the white South while simultaneously protecting its black population? It seems unlikely. Grant saw a double standard at work. The country tolerated terror by whites, but not by blacks. As he wrote after leaving office, If a Negro insurrection should arise in South Carolina, Mississippi, or Louisiana, or if the Negroes in either of these states should intimidate the whites from going to the polls, there would be no division of sentiment as to the duty of the president. It does seem the rule should work both ways. Once Reconstruction collapsed, it left Southern blacks for 80 years at the mercy of Jim Crow segregation, lynchings, poll taxes, literacy tests, and other tactics designed to segregate them from whites and deny them the vote. Black sharecroppers would be degraded to the level of debt-ridden serfs bound to their former plantation owners. After 1877, the black community in the South steadily lost ground until a rigid apartheid separated the races completely, a terrible state of affairs that would not be fixed until the rise of the civil rights movement after World War II. Grant deserves an honored place in American history, second only to Lincoln, for what he did for the freed slaves. He got the big issues right during his presidency, even if he bungled many of the small ones. The historian Richard N. Current, who also saw Grant as the most underrated American president, wrote, "By backing radical Reconstruction as best he could, he made a greater effort to secure the constitutional rights of blacks than did any other president between Lincoln and Lyndon B. Johnson." In the words of Frederick Douglass, "That sturdy old Roman, Benjamin Butler, made the Negro a contraband, Abraham Lincoln made him a free man, and General Ulysses S. Grant made him a citizen." Or in the simple prose of T. Jefferson Martin of Michigan, who wrote to Grant after he left office, "As a colored man, I feel in duty bound to return you my grateful and heartfelt thanks for your firm, steadfast, and successful administrations of our country, both as military chieftain and civil ruler of this nation. My dear friend to humanity."